Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today, both variations on the theme of school politics. I'd like to offer some comments on the current inflation scare, but I didn't have time to prepare a serious commentary. For now, I'll just say inflationary pressures are real, complicated, not easy to solve, and are making people quite angry, as inflation often does. I see many of my comrades on the left dismissing these worries as illusory or exaggerated. I even saw one commentary arguing that inflation is good for you. This is a profound misreading, one that will make you look way out of touch with the effects of rising prices on people's living standards. I'll have more to say in a blog post in a few days, and I'll do an audio version of that argument next week. The victory of Glenn Youngkin, longtime private equity maher at Carlyle, over centrist Dem hack Terry McAuliffe in Virginia, and the near loss of Phil Murphy, the not-bad Goldman Sachs alum in New Jersey last week, had a lot to do with school politics. Those two words cover a lot of ground. There was a lot of parental anger over extended school closures, something I completely understand as the father of a New York City public high school student who had a miserable time during Zoom school last year. These concerns are often dismissed by people, liberals and leftists, who valued safety above all, often with rude caricatures of parental selfishness. But it was a truly miserable experience all around, and it's not politically helpful to ignore that. But of course, there's much more to the school issue than extended closures. There are mask mandates and vaccination mandates, both of which I'm fine with, but many on the right don't agree. Those objections seem like a symptom of the American right's deepening nihilism, which has amplified their long-standing contempt for expertise, combined with crude notions of personal freedom and individual choice that totally disregard the impact of one's actions on others. It's one thing to object to drug laws and libertarian grounds. It's another to apply that reasoning to an infectious disease that can sicken and kill other people. And then there's the controversy over critical race theory, CRT, which is especially resonant in Virginia, the former capital of the Confederacy. You can say, rightly, that CRT is taught in law schools, not public primary and secondary schools, but that refutation will cut no ice with people who don't want their kids to learn the ugly truth about race in American history, from slavery through Jim Crow and into the present. People who will embrace any excuse to keep it out. Right-wing activists, notably Chris Rufo, a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, have found CRT to be a great target for whipping up popular rage. As he told The New Yorker's Benjamin Wallace Wells in June, its connotations are all negative to most middle-class Americans, including racial minorities, who see the world as creative rather than critical, individual rather than racial, practical rather than theoretical. Strung together, the phrase critical race theory connotes hostile, academic, divisive, race-obsessed, poisonous, elitist, anti-American. That's the end of the quote from Rufo. All of which is nonsense. In its original form, CRT was an examination of the enormous role of race in shaping American law and politics. That's precisely what the right, organized or not, doesn't want to hear about. But they're quite clever at making up a lot of stories to hide their agenda. Also part of the hidden agenda, to use anger over school politics, not just CRT, but closures and mandates, all of which are very different things, to undermine support for public schools and to promote charters, vouchers, and privatization. Sadly, people on the left end of the political spectrum, liberals and radicals, have not responded to these challenges deftly. Barack Obama, whose post-presidency gets more embarrassing by the day, not that his presidency was so great either, and Terry McAuliffe both dismissed parental anger in patronizing ways, treating discontent over extended closures as being the same as racist contempt for the teaching of American history. These are not helpful interventions. To explore these issues more deeply, we'll hear from Lisa Graves, an expert in the right's funding and strategy networks, and Natalia Mailman Petrozella, a historian who studied school politics. First, Lisa Graves. She's the former executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, where she did a lot of research into the Koch network and the broader right-wing infrastructure of think tanks and front groups. She's now the executive director of True North Research, an organization based in Wisconsin, which she founded in 2017. Lisa Graves. Some of the so-called Parents' Rebellion or whatever didn't look entirely spontaneous. What kind of right-wing funding networks have been active in this place on this issue?
Well, we've seen a number of major national right-wing groups that weighed in Virginia that appeared to be spending not insignificant sums to try to influence the outcome of that election, including the Koch-funded Independent Women's Voice, actually Independent Women's Forum, which has an arm called the Independent Women's Voice, and other right-wing groups. We saw just a parade of right-wing activists go to the state, in particular to Loudoun County, including Charlie Kirk from Turning Point USA and others. And so this is clearly a place where the right wing wanted to unfurl its playbook toward 2022 and try to claim that they represent the voices of parents, even though most parents want their kids to be taught honest history and want their kids to be safe from infectious diseases.
How active are they elsewhere? Is this a widespread thing, or do they just zero in Virginia?
They were certainly active in Virginia. The two main elections that were happening this season, in essence, in 2021, were in New Jersey and in Virginia, but the focus appeared to be Virginia. We're anticipating that they'll be moving forward in a lot of other states toward 2022. And we know that one of these groups, if not several of them, are combining together to target Georgia next. I would suspect that they'll be looking hard at trying to make similar moves in Arizona, Wisconsin, and other swing states in 2022.
Now, people often talk about the Koch brothers. Now it's just down to one, the Koch network. Who are we talking about exactly? What kinds of personnel and what kinds of institutions are behind this this funding?
Well, one of the groups that we've looked at quite a bit is called the Independent Women's Voice, IWV. It is the 501c4 arm of a charity or a charitable group called the Independent Women's Forum, IWF. IWF has been funded by the Koch fortune. The Koch fortune is the fortune from the Charles Koch Corporation, which is Koch Industries, and the philanthropies that he has created and the groups that he's launched. And in fact, that group, the Independent Women's Forum and Independent Women's Voice, were co-located, co-housed, basically shacked up with Charles Koch's flagship political arm, which is called Americans for Prosperity and was previously known as Citizens for a Sound Economy. And so Koch money is not the only money that IWF has. It's been a pay-to-play group for a long time. It has, for example, received money from Juul for e-cigarettes. That was an e-cigarette company. Well, it has actively promoted e-cigarettes and tried to downplay parents' concerns about vaping. And it has been funded by other corporations and people with ties to the fossil fuel industry, while it has also tried to fuel efforts to basically stop efforts to mitigate climate change, basically fueled climate change denial or doubt.
What about this Chris Rufo fellow? What's his relation to this crowd?
Well, he definitely is. I'm not sure who's funding him, but he is someone who has launched another one of these efforts and tried to fan the flames of outrage about teaching of history in American schools, as well as other issues. And so we don't have a full set of information yet on his funders. There's always a delay in part when there's philanthropic funding. You don't learn about which foundations funded a group until the following year. But then there could be a substantial amount of funding from individuals that isn't passed through a foundation or possibly even corporations. We don't know his full set of funders.
How opaque is this stuff generally? Can you generally figure out who's writing the checks, or is it more difficult than that?
The ones that are funded by foundations, that's traceable, again, with that one-year time delay. But for individuals who write big checks, that's information that very rarely comes out. Now, you know, Rufo has been tied to his work with the Manhattan Institute, which is one of the longstanding state policy network groups. And we have traced the primary funding to the state policy network groups to a number of these big sort of right-wing billionaires, including Koch, but others as well. And we know that Manhattan Institute has had a wide range of funders over the years, including corporations as well as individuals. And so there's a whole set of groups that are individuals, really, who are trying to, well, I would say that they're certainly raking in money for their organizations by fanning the flames about critical race theory. Critical race theory, as you know, I'm sure, is an elective class taught at some law schools, not all law schools. And it talks about the structural racism in U.S. law. It's not a course that's taught to elementary school kids or middle school kids or high school kids. It's a law school class. And one of my friends said, if your elementary aged child is studying critical race theory, congratulations, they're in law school. because it really is a an effort by the right wing and some of these right wing outlets to fan the flames of a controversy that doesn't really exist. It's not really being taught to elementary school kids or middle school kids or senior or high school kids for that matter.
But then, of course, is there dishonest proxy for any treatment, honest treatment of the role of race in American history? They don't want to hear about slavery. They don't want to hear about Jim Crow. They just want to forget about all that, right? So they're fanning this outrage, but really what they want to do is suppress the learning of real history.
Well, that's right. One of the juxtapositions that I think is apparent, certainly since Charlottesville and beyond, is this idea that no one can criticize the statues of the men who attacked the Union, who attacked the United States government, who were traitors to our Constitution. And yet, if we talk about race and the impact of racist policies in America, including, you know, the origin story of slavery in America, then some people on the right, are up in arms and claiming that their kids are being taught to hate America. That's not true. One of the things that happened with the Independent Women's Forum, for example, is that they put out a guide last month about how to talk about Christopher Columbus, which denied, you know, what Christopher Columbus's actual diary said, which, as Howard Zinn documented in his book, People's History of the United States, and which is documented in the actual diary of Christopher Columbus, which is that when he sailed into the Caribbean, the first entry in his diary after he was rescued by the Arawak tribe on the island that his ship was near was that with a few men, he could enslave them all. And then he, in fact, did go back to Spain, secure the funding to make these big slave raids and bring slaves from the Caribbean back to the old world, to Europe. And so the idea that Christopher Columbus, you know, was not a slaver is simply false. He was. And telling kids that that's part of our history doesn't mean hating America. It just means understanding the roots, some of the roots, both the good and the bad, and understanding where we are right now in this country in terms of some of the challenges we face trying to have a truly diverse and thriving society.
What is the agenda behind this, aside from like controlling the curriculum? But did they have an agenda about privatizing the public schools? I'm reminded of the period after Brown v. Board of Education that Nancy McLean has written about, when people like Milton Friedman and James Buchanan used white resentment of desegregation to fuel private schools. Are we seeing something like that now, where you have this unholy alliance between racists and libertarians?
Well, I think so. You know, I think it's everything old is new again, or as one of the famous songs in history said, here's the new boss, same as the old boss. You know, this is this effort to try to attack public schools, the idea of public schools that, you know, really has a strong history of white supremacy. It's been part of our culture for a long time now. Now, Charles Koch's PR folks said that they're not specifically funding any of the attacks on CRT, but what they are doing is funding the groups that are attacking CRT. So it's a nice little sort of legal defense that they didn't fund a project specifically to attack it, but the groups that they have long funded are at the forefront of attacking public schools. And what we're seeing, as you point out, is that many of these groups are then calling for kids to be withdrawn from public schools. They're pushing for more homeschooling. And they're pushing for the money that is allocated to fund public schools to be basically allocated for themselves or to parents through, you know, transferable sort of savings accounts or what have you, which would further erode public schools. And on a related note, one of the things that has recently popped is a renewed effort to say that the United States government should not have any role in public education. It's a court case that's making its way ultimately, perhaps to the U.S. Supreme Court, to say that there should not be a U.S. Department of Education, that the U.S. government should have no role in a public education under a sort of libertarian or what Leonard Leo called a, quote, structural constitution that would, in essence, forbid Congress from allocating funds in this area when there's not an express grant of power in this area. So instead of the longstanding constitutional doctrine of Congress having the power to do what's necessary and proper to advance the powers that are assigned to it in the Constitution, this idea that it can't weigh in on certain matters, and education is one of those that this particular case is advocating. And as your listeners may recall, there was a moment a number of years ago when the then governor of Texas was running for president and couldn't name the three agencies that he would have destroyed if he became president. The Department of Education is one of those. So this is part of the longstanding sort of right-wing libertarian agenda. And as you point out, Milton Friedman really marked that territory out by saying there should not be public schools at all, which he called government schools. There should not be public universities at all. And this is part of the sort of purest extremist thinking by libertarians, is that we should not have public schools at any level.
Now, that Leo you mentioned, that's the Federalist Society, right?
He's one of the leaders of the board of the Federalist Society. He recently left his day job at the Federalist Society after he was exposed by the Washington Post in an article by Robert O'Hara and Sean Boberg in May of 2018. He was exposed for having raised and transferred substantial amounts of money to groups to help pack the courts for Trump. And now he leads a group that is a so-called donor advising group that basically advises the super rich people who have been funding his efforts on who they should give money to. And I would be remiss if I didn't note of the confirmation vote for Brett Kavanaugh, that very controversial nominee of the U.S. Supreme Court, Leonard Leo bought a mansion in Maine along with paying off his mortgage that year. And so he had no requirement as a volunteer for Trump to disclose his funding, what money he might have been receiving from outside sources beyond his so-called time off from the Federalist Society. But the fact is that after that article came out, he left that position within the Federalist Society to now help govern it while raising now untold salary for himself, advising these very rich people who are intent on packing our federal court system with right-wing judges.
Well, they've been quite successful at their task, haven't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, Executive Director of True North Research. What's the general state of this right-wing funding network now, Koch and his buddies? Are they healthy and active working their mischief?
Well, there's reportedly been, you know, a bit of a divide between some of the groups that Koch has funded and the full-throated endorsement or support for Trump. And so Charles Koch has been on a sort of a PR campaign in particular in this past year, where basically he suggested that he was wrong to get involved in partisan politics and that he didn't mean to help fuel this divide. And yet, as he was making that PR campaign, his operatives were super active in the Georgia Senate races in January. And they deployed hundreds of volunteers and substantial staff in the Virginia battle for the governor's race that was just won by the Republican, a Republican who was endorsed by Trump and whom Trump took credit for bringing to victory. And so on the one hand, you have some news articles that sort of quote, again, every election cycle in the last, 4 to 6 years now of Koch saying that he's, you know, he's not supporting Trump and he's, you know, not going to be involved in partisan divides, and then you see his flagship organizations heavily involved in electoral partisan politics on behalf of what I would consider to be some extreme candidates, as opposed to, you know, more moderates. And so the other part we've seen is that while Charles Koch again has denied that he's specifically funding the fight against CRT. We know that school boards have been a longtime target of Charles Koch's operations. They attempted to take over with school board candidates that were basically backed through independent expenditures by America's Prosperity, three different school boards in Colorado and other places. So we know that this is a longtime target of the Koch operation. And also we know that Charles Koch stepped right into the framework that Milton Friedman laid out, which was to attack public schools. And the very first nonprofit that we believe that Charles Koch ever founded was called the Center for Independent Education, which was devoted to advancing the idea of purely private schools, of not having public schools or not even having publicly funded universities. So schools has been the public school issue has been a longstanding issue for Charles Koch. It was sort of the issue he cut his teeth on as a young man, as a member and funder of the John Birch Society. And he's in his 80s, but he has created a number of groups that have continued to advance that agenda, which is an agenda of attacking the role of government in our society, the role of good government, the role of public schools in developing a thriving democracy.
Yeah, I was thinking as you were talking that, you know, you go back to the 70s when the New Right was very new, I guess, although it's always been around, but that latest manifestation was first making its presence felt. They were really obsessed with school board elections and had a whole strategy for winning school boards when they'd go to packed meetings on rainy nights when no one else was there and that sort of thing. They're, you know, these people really do have a long-term strategy and are quite clever at implementing it. But why are they so obsessed with schools? What is this? Why the centrality of schools to their agenda, to their operations?
Well, you know, one of the things that is particularly interesting, and this isn't just Koch, but by way of illustration, is that, you know, he has attempted to create, or engineer, he's an engineer by training, a real network to transmit his, what I consider to be his extreme anti-government ideology to children and to adults. And so people like Charles Koch see the schools as a mechanism for transmitting their personal ideology, their agenda, and they appear to dislike it when, you know, broader values are taught or values that are not so idiosyncratic themselves. We also saw that with Betsy DeVos and Dick DeVos in Michigan and Betsy DeVos's efforts to attack public schools even before she was the head of the Department of Education under Trump. She's someone who attacked schools for supposedly displacing churches as the proper center of American communities, even though under our Constitution, we have constitutional recognition of the notion of separation of church and state, that the government should not be involved in establishing religion. But Betsy DeVos has devoted substantial money over the years to attacking public schools and to pushing for taking money out of the public schools. And she's not the only one. A number of these billionaires who have very, I would say, idiosyncratic right-wing and extreme views have really targeted schools because they want the schools to teach what they want taught. And in some ways, what we're seeing manifest with this effort to inflame parents across the country by groups like the Independent Woman's Voice is that they are trying to suggest that each parent should be basically dictating what's taught in the public schools. And the fact is that in Virginia, for example, there's, you know, millions of public school students and you know, twice as many parents, at least, of those students. And you just cannot have every single individual parent in the United States dictating what books are taught in schools. You have to have a process where there's an opportunity for some input, but that people who are professional educators are determining the curriculum for kids. And so in some ways, what you have is this notion that any individual parent should be able to stop what's taught. And as you point out or imply, this is a long-standing tactic on the right. We've seen it with sex education, the effort to stop kids from learning basic information about biology. We're seeing it now with what's described as social and emotional learning, which is an attempt to address the fact that a lot of kids feel alienated at home and at school because they may have a different gender identity than they were born with and may really be struggling. In fact, the suicide rate for kids who are LGBTQ is, you know, just off the charts. And there's been an attempt by schools to try to address those emotional needs of kids who are struggling or kids who are struggling with some of the effects of the racism in our society, impacting their families, impacting, you know, their daily life. And so there's been an effort by schools to really respond to the needs of kids and also to ensure that they have basic information about critical thinking, that they're not taught to be sort of robotically obedient people, but that they can think critically. And some parents don't want their kids thinking critically.
The Koch Network and their buddies and the right generally have been very, very focused on state and local politics, much more so than Democrats and liberals have, it seems to me. I mean, it's just, you know, evidence of the fact they really are focusing on levels that of government that other people don't necessarily pay much attention to.
Well, I do think that it's sort of an interesting squeaky wheel situation where, you know, every year or, you know, certainly in even years, there are thousands of people who run for school board from, you know, both major political parties, some who aren't affiliated with a party, who are interested in helping our schools to thrive, helping ensure that they're adequately funded to have funding, not just for academics, but for the arts and athletics and all the things that enrich kids' lives. And those, some of those races are very political. Some of them, a lot of them aren't very political. But what's happening is there's an active effort right now by groups like the Independent Women's Voice and its allies to try to get right-wing parents to run for these school board seats in order to push this agenda. And it's not just about those races. It's also about trying to activate and maintain, in some ways, the outrage, in my view, of these potential voters. You know, to take the Facebook example where any positive emoji or something liking a story only got a score of one, but angry emojis or angry reactions to a story got a score of 5 in their algorithm. In some ways, that's really how Fox News operates and how these right-wing groups operate. In many ways, it's really how Trump has set an example for normalizing this appeal to outrage, exaggeration, lies, deceit, to push outrage, to push anger, to use that as a basis for a strategy for winning elections, and not actually talking about our future and our shared values and what we gain by working together in a pandemic, what we gain by coming together as a community, instead to push all of this division while claiming that it's people who are trying to address the inequality in our society who are the supposedly divisive ones. And so, you know, it really is a political strategy. And unfortunately, it's one that historically has been used by despots and fascists and dictators to try to use hate and anger and scapegoating as a way to gain power, to direct people's fears, economic fears, their concerns, to, you know, push that through a lens of racism, of you know, targeting minorities. As a way to lift up an outraged, in essence, electorate. And, you know, that history is a very terrifying and worrisome history, to see it being embraced and deployed, those tactics being embraced and deployed here in the United States with such aggression and such subterfuge, such sort of Orwellian effort to recast reality as something other than what it is, such as with the effort to claim that these tactics to steal elections are really about election integrity, to claim that, you know, talking about racism itself is racist, to attack the idea of teachers trying to address social emotional learning as somehow some sort of alien, anti-American, outrageous educational tactic when it's basic human psychology. And so I'm sorry for that long answer, but I do think that it really is about power. And it's about the people that Donald Trump has activated as his base, trying to maintain their outrage in order to win future elections.
All right, and this is the final 2 minutes question we always get to. What is to be done? How do we deal with these people? I think some of the Democrats, McAuliffe and Obama, sounded condescending and dismissive in their reaction to the fights in Virginia. What's your recommendation from having studied these characters for so long? About what's the best way to fight them?
Well, I think it is a real challenge because what's happening is, you have a portion of the population that's just not that engaged and involved. And so they're not, you know, really paying that much attention. They're focused on their own lives. And, you know, in that sense, more power to them. They're trying to be happy and survive. And then you have sort of this squeaky wheel minority of right wing activists who are really, raising quite a fuss. That's not to say that every single claim that's made is illegitimate, but there's an outrage machine that is being fully deployed and massively funded, both through the corporate sector, through Fox, as well as through these right-wing groups that are secretly funded to sort of help fuel this outrage, or the deploying their general support funds to fuel this outrage. So, you know, I think what's going to have to happen in this coming year is that people are going to have to be talking about our shared values, our common values as Americans, and what we want for our future and for our kids, on climate and on a thriving, you know, public society, and have those conversations about what we can be together, and to try to build that vision and really activate people to come out for a positive vision versus just be beholden to a minority that's been whipped up into such a frenzy.
That was Lisa Graves, Executive Director of True North Research. It's been a while since I did an interview through a telephone. Apologies for the sometimes muffled audio quality. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
Passionate shouts and red with anger, I lost myself through alleys of mysteries. I went up and down like a demented train. Don't take it personal, I choose my own fate. Follow love, I follow hate. Searching for something that makes the heart move, I found myself, but my best possession, locked into the shade, threatened to drift away. Don't take it personal, I choose my own fate.
That was some of Adventures Close to Home, a cover of an old Slit song by Telenovela. And now for a historian's point of view on school politics. Natalia Mailman Petrozella is Associate Professor of History at the New School of Manhattan. Her book, Classroom Wars, Language, Sex, and the Making of Modern Political Culture, was published by Oxford University Press in 2015. It was an examination of fights over bilingual education and sex education, mostly in 1970s California. There are a lot of similarities between then and now, and, in fact, to fights during the 1940s when the American Legion worried about schools brainwashing kids to be communists. She had an article in the Washington Post last week urging us to look more carefully at the anger behind the school culture wars, which made me think it was worth talking to her. Not only were there issues around remote schooling, but the curricular changes over the last couple of years have been real and dramatic, mostly welcome to the likes of me, but not to everyone. Here's Natalia Mailman Petrozella with more. You wrote a book, or published a book, on the classroom wars, mostly of the 70s in 2015, focusing mainly on bilingual education and sex education. Now it's race and wokeness. But is it a very similar underlying story, despite the change in details?
Yeah, well, one of the things that's interesting is when I wrote that book, it was about sex education and bilingual education, which aren't on their face about race, but once you kind of like scratch the surface, the concerns that parents raised about both of these issues absolutely were about race. And they were about concerns about race mixing, concerns about kind of civil rights excess in the 60s and 70s. And what did they fear the outcome would be? Well, a lot of what they feared was taxpayer-funded teachers who were leftists and, you know, sort of in the thrall of their unions and all of this leftist ideology, corrupting children through these curricula and turning them into communists who hated their parents and hated America. Now, that is word for word the rhetoric of the 60s and 70s curricular battles, and that is so similar to what we see today. And so the curricula, I think today, is more explicitly about race than the ones that were at stake in the book that I wrote, but race is there in all of them, and the fears of what that kind of pedagogy will do are expressed in almost exactly the same idiom. I mean, it's really alarming, even to a historian. It's amazing how close the similarity, how close it
well,
is.
Well, you know, that's history for you. There's nothing new under the sun, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Is it the same cast of characters, demographically speaking, that's causing all the fuss?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I mean, it's hard to know exactly. I mean, I would say that certainly there's a strong whiteness to a lot of the parents who are complaining about these curricular changes. And so you see white parents and a lot of white women who are angry about what's going on. I would say that one of the differences is that there's a very strong kind of religious antipathy to what's going on in schools that is part of the conversation in the 60s and 70s. So this is a moment, right, when Christian conservatives are realizing, because of the Cold War, we've tried to kind of stay out of politics, but when the fight is against godless communism, like, maybe this is our moment. And so you really have like the Christian Crusade and some other conservative churches really having a voice in these curricular wars. Today, I think because the fight is not about against godless communism and the battles are less explicitly about morality, you know, in the way that sex ed was, you don't have a kind of religious opposition as strong as you did back then.
But there's still that same fear about alien radical forces programming the brains of our children.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I guess I should say, you know, not to like paint with too broad of brushstrokes on today's issues, CRT is what critical race theory in schools is what we hear about, I think, as the most, the scariest thing that could be happening to kids. But I think one of the reasons that this is in the news so much is because that particular set of kind of fear-mongering tactics has jumped out of right-wing media to engage other parents who might not be worried about their kids becoming like race warriors, but are pissed off about other things happening in schools that they also see as the result of kind of leftist excess. And in that regard, detracking of math curriculum or getting rid of gifted and talented programs or prolonged school closures, all of that stuff is seen as, you know, being part of a left agenda. And so I think people who aren't necessarily like fired up about critical race theory turning their kids into communists might give a pass to some of that more extreme rhetoric because of these other issues.
I watched an interview from CNN with four Northern Virginia mothers, and they did not seem like, you know, baying racists or ignoramuses. They were mostly concerned about the extended school closures, and Virginia had some of the longest school closures in the country. Are there multiple forces operation here? And then, of course, Obama steps in and says this is all just trumped up fake culture war stuff. Right. And McAuliffe says parents have no business in discussing the curriculum of the schools. So, yeah, how do we sort that out? I mean, are there some more complicated forces at work? And then are the liberals being ham-handed in their response?
Yes. So much to unpack in what you were saying there. Let me see if I can get all of it. So that CNN clip of those four white women got roundly skewered on social media. And I have to say that I got skewered for sharing it. And I didn't share it saying, like, you go, sisters. I shared it saying, like, how interesting. These women are not talking about critical race theory. I would love to know more.
Well, they explicitly said it had nothing to do with their opinion.
Yeah, exactly. None of them had brought it up. And then the interviewer asked them, are you concerned about critical race theory? Or she said the mandates. I assume she meant mask and vaccine. And they were like, no, that doesn't really enter into what we're thinking. I thought all that was interesting. I am a qualitative researcher. I would like to know more about who those women are. I would like to see the whole interview because it was clearly edited. I wanted to know more. Oh my God, the blowback that I got for even wanting to know more was intense. Why do we care about these white women? Like, you know, that we have an overemphasis on their interest. They're just lazy, entitled wine moms who are pissed off their kids weren't in school so they couldn't go to brunch. Yeah, that was literally, and that's like a critique from the left, by the way. And I emphasize because... Yeah, when you ask this question about, like, has the left been ham-fisted? Absolutely. On education, I think they have been a disaster in the past year. I mean, if you think what I just explained, I mean, mothers, largely mothers, who were pissed off about school closures and the fact that, you know, women have left the workforce in enormous numbers in the past year and a half in a way that's going to have impact for a generation. When women raised issues about that, the critique from the left and from Democrats was like, well, whatever, like, you know, you'll be fine. Kids are resilient. Figure it out, et cetera. And I think that really was an awful response. And then on this CRT issue, unfortunately, I think that the response of the left has been like a real kind of like sneering elitism that as folks who aren't even like ideological culture warriors, but as they like wonder about curricular changes that they're seeing happening in schools, which I do think are real. I don't think it's CRT necessarily, but I do think are real in the past year. They're mostly told, what are you talking about? Critical race theory is only taught in law schools. You're imagining things. And I think, yes, critical race theory is not something that your fourth grader is learning probably anywhere. That is true. But look, come on, in the last year and a half since the murder of George Floyd, curriculum has been changing in meaningful ways. I actually think that's a good thing, by the way. But I think that the response of Democrats, that if you wonder about that or you notice it, you are like some racist fabulist who's imagining things, that is not helpful either. And so, like in Virginia, if you listen to Glenn Youngkin's language, and trust me when I tell you, I'm no Glenn Youngkin fan at all or Republican voter. He was really skillful at not being middle of the road enough to alienate the anti-CRT culture warriors, but being middle of the road enough and talking about, we just want your kids to all feel safe in school and to have a school that they can go to and learn history, the bad and the good. That sounds like a pretty good deal if, like, that's your core, if education's your core issue. And so, yes, I think that the Democrats totally flubbed this. And not great.
I just reread an essay by Stuart Hall from the 1990s about political correctness and PC speech and such. And he makes the point that there's a kind of vanguardism at work with political correctness. And he said, you know, a lot of what they're talking about is correct. I mean, he's not arguing with a lot of the underlying principles. But there's this urge to impose standards or curricula or modes of speech on people who aren't there. And it's a shortcut to doing the hard work of persuading people and organizing a constituency. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that that's right. I mean, I think I am, for the most part, it sounds like Stuart Hall too in that essay, which I don't think I've read, sympathetic to the sort of social change that these folks are trying to enact. But the emphasis on certain speech and behavioral codes, I think, can be extraordinarily alienating and alienating to the very folks who are supposed to be empowered by it. I mean, we see a version of this debate, I think, playing out a lot recently, or not so recently, but in the last several months or year over the term Latinx, right? Which is something which is very common on university campuses and other places. But I'll tell you, for my Argentine immigrant mother with a very thick accent, is she's like, Latin what? Like, that's not who I am. And I think that there are a lot of people who feel that way. And I think that that to me is emblematic of that sort of like fetishization of certain like language and behavioral codes, which can actually be very counterproductive in itself, but certainly when weaponized by the right, it's such an easy target.
I'm speaking with historian Natalia Mailman Petrozella. In some ways, this is reminiscent to me of the period after Brown v. Board of Education, when a lot of, you know, racist Virginians didn't want to send their kids to schools with black kids in them. But then you had people like Milton Friedman and James Buchanan seizing that discontent and using it to push a libertarian privatization agenda. Rufo and, you know, his anti-CRT crowd seemed to have a similar idea. They want to use this sentiment against CRT as a way of privatizing the schools. And I'm not sure that the response to this discontent has really taken full measure of this. What do you think of it?
Yeah, I think that that's right. I mean, there was a perverse turn of events in the past 18 months as Democrats kind of pushed for extended school closures and now still for a pretty hollowed out version of education in a lot of very blue areas. And you can say that's the right thing to do or not, but I think it is a strange phenomenon that it's Democrats that are pushing for that and perhaps really undermining faith in the public institution to which they've been such allies for years, when and Republicans are actually benefiting from that as people lose confidence in public schools and they're like, okay, great. We've got charters over here. We've got privates over here. Don't vote for the union candidate. You know, like, let's go. And I think for that reason, I think that it really behooves Democrats to be pointing that out and to be like making education their center issue. I mean, Michelle Goldberg had a good article the other day, I thought, in the Times, where she argued like it is incumbent upon Democrats to make making schools normal and fun and joyous, not just open again, their top priority. And that's everything from making sure that there are pay incentives for bus drivers and for, like, to fix the supply chain with cafeteria food and all these things. Because a lot of this stuff, it's not all Democrats' fault. The supply chain issue is not, I would not blame Joe Biden for that or any blue state mayor or governor. But failing public schools are not good for the Democrats long term. And so they should figure that out.
Yeah, well, I have a 15-year-old son in public schools, and it was hell when he was out of school or doing remote. And I think a lot of people didn't really understand how awful it was for many of us. And now it's just so much better. He's back in school. And I really applaud Bill de Blasio for having the nerve to push it when a lot of, you know, his blue state mayors and governors were resisting it. So it needs to be taken more seriously than a lot of people left of center are.
Yeah, no, I agree. Look, I was in a very similar boat to you. I had last year one kid in private school and one kid in public school in New York City. And the public school one is 8 years old. And come on, 30 minutes of morning meeting and then go on YouTube and like do some worksheets. And then when your parents raise questions about like, what the hell is going on here? It's like, how dare you? Do you want to kill teachers? You know, like, how dare you raise questions about this? And I mean, it was horrible. And I do think that people who are not parents don't fully realize that. And I also think parents who had their kids in private school don't fully realize that. One, obviously, if you can send your kids to private school, that suggests you have a lot of other sorts of privileges that probably support that whole remote era in a way that made life probably a lot easier. But, you know, when I heard, I believe Gavin Newsom or some other Democratic politician who was like, oh, we went through Zoom school too, and his kids went to private school. I'm like, look, I had one in private, one in public sitting next to each other. And the public school, Zoom school, was like 30 minutes of live teaching on like possibly working technology. The one in private school was like all day, you know, oh, do you have a problem? Tech support. I mean, it's like a different universe. And I'm not actually faulting the teachers for that. That is the result of decades of defunding of public education. But I think what you're saying is absolutely right. If you had a public school kid who was not truly in school, it was a big problem last year. And I think a lot of parents are not going to forget that. And so Democrats have to make it right.
A couple of points you make in the Washington Post piece, I think, as we tend towards 20 minutes. You said, for one, school issues are not cipher for real concerns. They're central to contemporary political culture in Virginia and beyond. A lot of people misunderstand that or don't appreciate that. But what are you thinking of exactly?
I think like every time that like school issues flare up in a huge way, like they are right now, people are always like, either like, oh my God, like, why is this happening? Which I think reflects a kind of sexism about not paying attention to the sorts of issues that like women are paying attention to a lot, because mothers are often the ones managing their kids' education. But I also think there's a bit of a snobbery around education that like political concerns about education are really just code for something else. You can't really be worried about what your kid's learning in school. Like, it's about racism or it's about taxes. But I think actually that reflects like a misunderstanding of how much parents actually do care about what their children are. I don't even want to say what they're learning, because I think it's more than academic, but what their school experience is. Like, I think we are in a moment right now where people are seeing public schools worth fighting for, that there is this contestation over what should happen in those buildings. And I'm perhaps that is due to a kind of renewed appreciation for going to school, because so many kids went 18 months without it. And so there's this like new sense that what happens in there matters, and that parents, especially after they spent a year and a half managing their own kids' education or looking over their shoulder and seeing what was going on in class, that parents like deserve a bigger seat, a more powerful seat at that table than they've had at other moments, or that they even wanted. Like, I think of like when I used to drop my kid off at school and I was just like, bye, see you at 3. That presumption they'd be taken care of, you know, till 3 p.m. by someone else went out the window. Now, every day I drop them off, I'm like, I hope it's fine. I hope there are no quarantines, you know.
And I follow that map. The DOE map every day.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
You argue in the book that the school wars in California in the 70s helped fuel Prop 13, the tax revolt in Prop 13. Do you see something similar coming out of this moment?
We'll see. I mean, I think, you know, and part of my argument there is sort of what I just said, that like the conventional interpretation of Proposition 13, this anti-property tax revolt, was like, oh, and it was about property and it was about taxes, and then they happened to like kill schools in the process. But one of the arguments that I'm making is like, no, there was this brewing antipathy and like anxiety about what was going on in schools, and that contributed to people not wanting to pay big taxes to what they thought of as a questionable school system. We'll see. I mean, I think Rufo and his crowd are unapologetic about what they're trying to do is to stir up anti-union sentiment, anti-public school sentiment, and to fuel homeschooling.
And they have a lot to work with at this point, too.
Oh, totally, totally. I mean, Youngkin has a big education platform and he wants to increase teacher pay, but he's also a huge charter advocate, you know? And I think we'll see what happens. I don't know. I really don't know. Is it going to be like a property tax revolt like that? I don't know, but it might be new enthusiasm for charters or for private school vouchers. And I can't blame people. I mean, I should be acting politically as more than a mom right now, which I am, because I study this stuff as a career. But if I was just a pissed off mom, if my primary, most intense experience of kind of school politics had been the last 18 months, I can't say it wouldn't have turned me right. And I know that's saying, knowing that the Republicans are dead set on destroying public education, which I think is a crucial institution. But if all I had seen is the difference between what private school was offering and what public school is offering, I can't promise I wouldn't have voted for someone that could create a better educational experience for my child. And I think most people vote in that way. I think it takes a pretty enlightened voter to not be most directly, you know, what's going to benefit me and my family. And I don't think that's a terrible thing necessarily. And that's sort of the nature of our system.
Okay, and finally, we expect an awful lot of our schools. Liberals think education is a solution for class polarization, but it's really not up to that task. And conservatives want them to be part of a program of moral renovation, which is not going to work. It's like they never met a teenager. Mm-hmm. That all gets buried in these sorts of controversies. Do we expect too much of schools?
Yes, we definitely expect too much of schools. I mean, one of the things that was very clear last year when schools closed, all of a sudden it's like, wait, this is the only mental health support that these kids get. This is where they get two meals a day. This is the only place that anyone's checking in if they've been abused at home. Like, you know, all of that stuff falls to schools. And it speaks to the centrality of schools in kids' lives in a way that I think is like powerful and wonderful that can happen. But it also, given this is an institution that has been sucked dry by austerity policies for a long, long time, that's not great. It suggests that we need lots of other kind of supports around school. And, you know, the recent conversations and policies around childcare, I think, will help redress that, which is really good. But it's funny, I was pissed off listening to some of the policy conversations around childcare voiced in this very high-minded way by Democrats who had not opened their mouth on school closures. Like, nope, sorry, we're not going to talk about that. And to me, like, we've got to talk about all of it, even if it means confronting, you know, some uncomfortable things for liberals about the way that school policy has gone wrong.
That was Natalia Mailman-Petrozella, an associate professor of history at the New School and author of Classroom Wars, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2015. She had only 20 minutes to talk, so I'd like to have her back soon to continue the conversation. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, in honor of Veterans Day, some of Captain Beefheart's Veterans Day poppy from his 1969 masterpiece, Trout Mask Replica. Till next week, bye.
Veterans Day poppy, it don't get me high, it can only make me cry. It can never grow another sun like the one who warmed me my days after rain and warmed my breath. My life's blood streaming empty, she cries. It don't get me high, it can only make me cry. You're a Veteran Day poppy.